Tēnā koutou, no mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. This morning, breaking news in the Middle East as Iran reportedly launches drone attacks on Israel. Then, News Hub, gone. TVNZ current affairs decimated. But there is another media outlet in strife.
Why is he so worried about RCR and the fact that it's off air at the moment if he doesn't regard it as a real threat to his audience?
And after years of stagnation with the Crown over a treaty settlement, the new chair of New Zealand's largest iwi is striking an optimistic tone.
Do you think it's more likely or not that Ngā Puhi can reach a settlement with the Crown within 5 years?
I think it's likely. But you know what? The Crown can switch Ngā Puhi off just like that.
We will have that interview for you shortly. But first, this morning in breaking news, Israel's Defence Force says Iran has launched an attack against Israel. Dozens of so-called suicide drones have been launched and are currently headed towards Israel. The IDF says they have technology to intercept the drones before they strike. The attack comes after an airstrike on Iran's embassy in Syria, which killed a senior Iranian official. Former Prime Minister Helen Clark is with us this morning. We wanted to start with this breaking news. What is your reaction to this news?
I guess it's no surprise, Jack. Israel bombed a diplomatic premise of the Iranians. The Iranians vowed revenge. They've launched drones. They probably know that Israel has pretty good defences against such things. It may well be very, very highly calibrated. But it does point to how tense the situation in the Middle East is with the ongoing spillover impacts of the war on Gaza.
Iran, of course, backs Hamas and Hezbollah. So considering that airstrike on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, which, of course, the IDF has not claimed any responsibility for as of yet, would Israel theoretically be justified in that airstrike?
No, you can't be justified in bombing diplomatic premises. That's absolutely a no-no. So they would have to have expected retaliation from that. It looks like the retaliation is probably something they can manage with their defences. Let's see as they get nearer to Israel in the next couple of hours or so. But nonetheless, this is not sustainable. To have a country which is basically has very difficult relationships with so many of its neighbours, going back to an unresolved conflict between Palestinians and Israel, this is what has to be resolved. Mm.
The Foreign Minister has just wrapped up an extensive international itinerary and meetings with his counterparts in the United States. You have expressed concern about what you think is New Zealand moving closer to a Tier 2 status or Pillar 2 status with AUKUS. Can you just run us through your concerns?
My concerns are both of process and of substance. On process, there was no warning before the election that a government of the centre-right would very quickly swerve to much greater active engagement with the United States in the form of formal agreements like AUKUS. So there's a lack of transparency here. Secondly, their excuse or rationale has been, oh, the Labor government was doing that. Well, the Labor government said, we're prepared to explore it. They have now gone rather more steps beyond that, as Audrey Young pointed out in the Herald in recent days, with the Blinken-Peters statement talking about actively engaging with AUKUS Pillar 2. So then, what's the issue with that? The issue is, what are we up for? What exactly are the capabilities that New Zealand needs? How much are we prepared to spend? Where is this leading us to? Do we really need quantum technology? Do we need offensive cyber warfare capacity? Do we need hypersonic weapons? This is very high-tech military equipment. So I think New Zealanders need to be aware that there could be considerable costs with this. I'd conclude by saying that my experience is that you can engage with the United States on military operations. We did it with Afghanistan. We did not do it with Iraq. But I think it's better to approach this on a case-by-case basis as a friendly country rather than enter a new formal agreement which may see us signing up for rather more than we ever bargained.
You've outlined your concerns when it comes to process, and you see this as being a shift from the previous Labor government. But let's talk about some of those substance issues. As part of the defence review last year, New Zealand Secretary of Defence Andrew Bridgman said recently, quote, "The strategic environment has deteriorated more quickly than we imagined, and that our recent defence policy was appropriate for a more benign world that no longer existed." Do you agree with that sentiment?
Well, the world's not benign, is it? I mean, the level of conflict around the world is at a quite a high level since in recent decades. But the issue is, do we keep our heads and say, does what we're doing contribute to trying to lower tensions, or does it contribute to raising them? Now, it's an open secret, is it not, that AUKUS, the nuclear submarine agreement, which Australia, the US and the UK have, is aimed at China. China also happens to be the biggest trading partner for New Zealand, twice the size of Australia's export take from us, and rather more from the US. So we're going to identify with something which seeks to protect us from our major trading partner. This somehow doesn't quite add up. I think we need to keep a very New Zealand lens on what's happening here.
But the China of 2024 is very different to the China with which you signed a free trade agreement. When you consider the motivations of Chinese President Xi Jinping, his ambitions, how do those ambitions for China today differ from when you were Prime Minister?
Well, I don't think they differ at all with respect to New Zealand. Obviously, he is a very assertive leader, and we see the skirmishing in the South China Sea. But let's face it, the US has also changed since that free trade agreement was signed with China. We've had the Trump presidency. And what hasn't changed since the Trump presidency is the escalation in tension between the United States and China. So we are being asked to buy in to that escalation. And I don't think that's an appropriate role for New Zealand. We should be ones working with our Pacific friends to try to keep that zone of peace and harmony in the South Pacific, not contribute to it.
Would you accept that a key tenet of the Xi Jinping thought doctrine, if you like, first of all, of China as a preeminent global power, but also the reabsorption of Taiwan?
Well, obviously the reabsorption of Taiwan would be a bloody and brutal business which none of us would want to see or support. And that's why historically the US and others have played a very careful line on that. They've never supported Taiwan independence. But of course, in recent years, there've also been different kinds of signals going from the US to Taiwan. When the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, went there, the third most important person in the US lineup, this signals to China that the US will buy into a fight on this. So the ambiguity, the constructive ambiguity, strategic ambiguity that the US used to have on the Taiwan issue has also become somewhat blurred. Look, what we see is every time President Biden and President Xi get on the phone call together or meet in San Francisco as they did at APEC last year, things calm a bit. We need more of that talking and less of the ratcheting up of the escalation.
You've noted that the US bears significant parts of responsibility, in your view, for the increasing tensions between China and the US over recent years, in particular former President Donald Trump. But is China's behaviour towards Taiwan and the Philippines that which we would expect of a reasonable stakeholder?
No, but we're also conscious of the lessons of history, that when a new power emerges on the block, it's always rocky. So do we want to repeat the lessons of history and let that lead to an all-out conflict? Or do we want to be one of those voices that says, let's calm it here. Let's try and work through other means to resolve the differences that we have. Look, China is a dictatorship. Its values are not ours. That is not going to change anytime soon. That's why last year Chris Hipkins described the relationship as one of New Zealand's most important but also most complex. It is incredibly complex. But I think we have to keep looking at this through a clear-headed lens of what are New Zealand's interests, how do we keep the South Pacific as a zone of peace, and not contribute to an escalation in tensions.
Well, for a country that values a so-called independent foreign policy, How can we try and strike a middle ground between what you describe as a dictatorship and a democracy?
Well, you know, most of the world's governments don't look like New Zealand's, right? So if we were only ever to trade and interact with those who looked like a liberal Western democracy, the field would be pretty thin. So what we've been able to do, while keeping a principled position and always, you know, calling out China, whether it's in the West, where there's been horrific things done to minorities, whether it's Tibet or whatever, we've called it out. But we have also maintained an ability to talk and trade and accept investment and invest there and so on. So it requires some pretty astute diplomacy. And my concern is that if we are seen as lurching full on into one side of these rising tensions, we are going to imperil that careful balance that we've had with the independent foreign policy.
So give us an alternative vision then. How do you think New Zealand should try and approach this in the coming years if we don't join AUKUS Pillar 2 and strategic competition continues to intensify between the US and China? How do we navigate that position?
Well, we have to continue to be a voice for de-escalation, for jaw-jaw, not war-war, as it were. I am yet to be convinced that there's anything much that Pillar 2 offers that New Zealand, A, actually needs, and B, couldn't get through some other means of other agreements it has if it did need it. But I think, you know, sitting out Pillar 2 would be very wise at the moment.
Just out of interest, for how long have you considered China a dictatorship?
Oh, all my life. All my life.
Including when you signed a free trade deal? Yeah.
Absolutely. I absolutely knew what China was. You may recall I went to Beijing with Phil Goff, where he signed the agreement, and I witnessed it in April 2008. I think it was barely the month before I had made a statement as New Zealand Prime Minister calling out repression in Tibet. And that, you know, really rocked things up to the extent it was even questioned whether the visit would go ahead. Mm. But we felt we had to say something. You know, I was born in 1950. Mao swept to power in 1949. It has been a dictatorship all my life. But we are not going to change that. The US is not going to change that. China is not about to become a liberal democracy. Mm. But it is a major geopolitical force. It's a major economic force. It's the biggest export market for New Zealand. We have to be smart in how we deal with it.
The deadline for the Global Pandemic Accord is next month, just a month away. While we've got you, do you think the world is going to miss that deadline?
Well, there's several scenarios. One is that it completely fails and misses it. The second is that they do what I personally think would be sensible, which is bank what they've agreed so far. They can agree to high-level objectives and principles. There may be some substance they can agree to. And they need to agree to a process for taking forward the large outstanding issues of difference. Mm. That would be the sensible thing to take to the World Health Assembly, other than an abject failure.
And in a domestic setting, do you think New Zealand is right to expand the scope of the COVID inquiry?
Well, I haven't seen anything up to date on that, but I think the COVID inquiry was always important. We need to know, you know, objectively from people looking from outside how we did. I personally think we did quite well, but there were areas that could have been better. So when I co-chaired that independent panel on pandemic preparedness and response, we recommended that every country undergo a full review of how it handled COVID so that you could learn lessons for the future.
And finally, 6 months in, what do you make of Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's leadership style and approach to coalition management?
Well, I'd say learning on the job, as we all do. You know, I led minority coalition governments for 9 years. It's possible to do this, but what it needs is constant communication between the partners. And I'm not sure we're seeing that particularly well. We're seeing ministers surprised by what ministers from other parties are doing, for example. So I think if I had any advice, which would be presumptuous, it would be really look at those liaison functions between the PM's office, national ministers' offices, and the leaders' offices of the other parties and of their ministers. Because if you're not constantly communicating, there will be surprises, there will be dysfunction, and in the end, that ends up in trouble.
Tēnā koe. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. Former Prime Minister Helen Clark, live with us this morning from Waihee Beach. After the break on Q&A, they billed themselves as being distinctly different to the so-called mainstream media. But Reality Check Radio has at least one thing in common with the rest of us. They are struggling to stay afloat. Hoki Maiti, we welcome back to Q&A. It's been a grim week for media, with more journalism jobs lost than at any other point in our history. But along with News Hub and TVNZ Current Affairs, another outlet has announced it's struggling to stay afloat. Here's Fiona Owen.
New Zealand, it's time for a reality check. Reality check. RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Just over a year ago, Aucklanders who looked to the skies may have seen this plane towing a banner. RIP Woke Media, it said. It heralded the start of Reality Check Radio and, along with billboards and mass pamphleting, the impression that some serious money was backing the start-up. But 13 months later, Reality Check Radio, or RCR, is suddenly off the air and pleading for money via a lengthy and slick video.
The only way we're going to get back on air is by raising funds now.
I find it weird that an organisation would put so much effort into telling people they'd failed.
Sarah over there just keeps the office running.
Sean Plunkett, editor of another media startup, is showing us through the platform's expanding operation and pondering Reality Check Radio's sudden radio silence.
So I'm not sure if it isn't some sort of misguided sort of marketing ploy, to be honest. But once again, I haven't lost a wink of sleep wondering what's happening at Rabbit Hole Radio.
The fact that people like Plunkett, Sean Plunkett, call it Rabbit Hole Radio.
Longtime broadcaster and RCR presenter Peter Williams.
Why is he so worried about RCR and the fact that it's off air at the moment if he doesn't regard it as a real threat to his audience?
You're with Sean Plunkett on the platform today.
The platform is funded by a wealthy New Zealand family, The Rights. It claims to have around just under 262,000 listeners or viewers to their website or app and 1,200,000 visits a month to its social media.
There was certainly nobody that big or putting that amount of money into RCR right from the start, but there were some people of means, shall we put it, who were prepared to support the cause. And that was, I guess you'd call that, the seed capital, the startup capital. Ever since then, it's been just a dribs and drabs feed.
In just over 1 year since going on air, RCR has had over 350,000 Kiwis listen live.
Is that correct?
In over a year, we've had over 350,000 Kiwis tuning in to RCR.
Voices for Freedom, who generally don't speak to so-called legacy media, have decided to talk to Q&A. Ali Abi was one of the co-founders of Reality Check Radio.
Is this a marketing gimmick? I mean, are you just wanting to expand the business and so you've stopped it to get attention?
People have said that. That's been a strong criticism that's out there. Yes, they have. It's not the truth of the matter, though, is that because of the way we came out in the first instance, the situation was dire. We felt that what was needed was something to come out really strong from the beginning. I know that our listeners would like us to stick around and that it's just a matter of vying for the attention that is out there. You know, everything wants your attention right now. You have to find a way to get your point across to people. So it's completely genuine. It is the situation warranted that approach. And I think it's, you know, it's having a good result.
You hide, you know, you're afraid.
We want freedom!
Absolutely disgusting that you media have never told the truth.
Now you're
Voices Voices for Freedom have their roots in the so-called anti-vax movement. The idea of RCR was born out of the Parliament occupation. It saw a niche then to meet the needs of New Zealanders who felt unrepresented.
Taking on the mainstream, Chantelle Baker.
Mainstream media, as usual, in their little perch.
The man who cares so much and whose background is for real, Rodney Hyde.
Former ACT leader Rodney Hyde's RCR journey also began at the Parliament protest. But RCR presenters have since widened their key topics beyond their COVID concerns.
Well, that's what's crystallised it for me. Big topics weren't being discussed in the news and you couldn't partake. Things like, you know, treaty issues, climate change.
When they talk about co-governance, they're actually talking about dividing us.
Social credit system, 15-minute cities.
Well, that's what Reality Check Radio is all about.
Politicians, mostly right of centre, have been interviewed on Reality Check Radio. Over on the platform, most political parties have come on, but not, its editor says, the Greens.
They are trying to cancel us. I will keep asking.
But this week on the platform, it's all about the media.
Sean, all I'm asking from you is some professional courtesy.
OK, Paddy, so here's the professional courtesy.
Hey, Sean, stop for a second. Stop showing off to your listeners and just show a bit of professional courtesy and say, hey, Paddy, why don't you come on and do an interview?
The shrinking of mainstream media and the plummeting of trust in it is seen as timely for alternative start-up media. The donations, Alia B says, are starting to roll in.
The media landscape right now is a perfect opportunity to be, you know, really putting in your roots and being solid, having a solid foundation to take off.
I'll be honest, the platform doesn't have the answer yet, and there may never be a definitive answer. The world is moving much more quickly than it used to. So in those circumstances, I think what journalists and the media have to do is clearly define what their principles are, and whatever the technical environment they're in, stick to those principles and communicate with the potential audience.
Fighting and defending yourself.
Yeah.
Are you good at it?
Down in central Otago, Rodney Hyde is keeping his Reality Check Radio hat on. He soon hopes to be back behind the microphone.
We're not dead, but we need life support.
Fiona Owen with that report. After the break on Q&A, the new chair of New Zealand's largest iwi has just had his first meeting with the Treaty Negotiations Minister. So what's it going to take for Ngā Puhi to settle? With an estimated 160,000 people, Ngā Puhi is New Zealand's largest iwi. And with big populations in Te Taitokiro, Northland, Tāmaki, Makaurau and all around the country, many of its people live quite different lives. Now, the largest iwi has New Zealand's youngest iwi leader. Mane Tahere says age is relative. After all, as teenagers, his tūpuna were fighting in wars. But as he takes the reins of Te Runanga a iwi o Ngā Puhi, he has grand ambitions for his people. I sat down with him in Kaikohe this week and began by asking why he became the iwi chair.
I guess one has to be quite intentional at my age and wanting this gig. I guess when I reflect and think about it, we're kind of born into it in some ways. You know, I love being Ngā Puhi, everything about it, the complexity. So that's come from being born into our iwi and growing up with Ngā Puhi challenges. And you start to get a sense early around what responsibility is, what working together is in marae and hapu settings. And so I guess the drive has always been there from birth and growing up in a strong Ngā Puhi family. Well aware of history and legacy of our tūpuna. I stand on shoulders of those tūpuna, and so there is a level of heavy responsibility.
We're speaking today in Kaikohe. Yeah. By various measures, this rohe is among the economically poorest regions of the country, and in various social statistics, life outcomes are among the worst. Many of the people on the wrong end of those statistics are Ngā Puhi. What responsibility does the iwi have for that?
I think it's it's been a growing responsibility for iwi. Ngāpoi pre-settlement, as we all know, the notion of iwi across the country initially is about receiving settlement and growing the net worth and all of that. And that's been, for whatever reason, the priority. I've always felt in the last decade, iwi have had to pivot and really have a focus on social determinants rather than commercial growth. And so I've always thought that the balance was off kilter, and that iwi, and specifically Te Runanga, a iwi o Ngāpui, have got to have the balance. We are probably one of the biggest employees in those sectors. My organisations and my subsidiaries, we are around 250 staff within Te Kaikohe, Kohe across the mid-north. And so, you know, I don't take pleasure in having to have the highest number of employees in that sector, but it's a sign of that deprivation that we talk about. You know, Jack is really quite sad. It's just so disheartening in my mahi and becoming the chair. And I go out and I see 80-year-old grandmothers looking after tamariki and cow sheds or garden sheds. I have to stop and take a moment to collect myself, because our people are in that struggle. And we and our subsidiaries and our kaimahi are trying our best to pull that out. So we've had to be more socially responsive.
You say that you think the balance has been off, right? That there's been too much of a focus on what a settlement would mean from a commercial perspective, and that perhaps not enough energy for iwi around the motu has gone into some of those social deprivation issues. I just wonder if those two things are linked, though. Take Ngāpuhi for an example. Do you think if a deal had been signed earlier, the srohe wouldn't be as poor?
There is a connection. The deprivation has been there for a long time, 150, 60-odd years. A settlement doesn't relegate the responsibility of, when we signed a partnership of Te Tiriti and further Te Whakaputanga, doesn't relegate that to say if we settle we should be living in healthy homes and warm and a thriving economy. I think that's part of the discourse of not holding up the partnership. And probably hard line, yes, there is that correlation and connection, but I would also look at, in terms of settlement, what does that actually mean for Ngāpuhi? You know, we've seen settlements for the last 30 years around other iwi. It hasn't been perfect. I, for one, worked at the top of the South Island in Nelson with some of the settled iwi there, and doing awesome work, awesome mahi, progressive, with their challenges. But I can't help but think, when it comes to Ngāpuhi and the depth of Ngāpuhi, if we were to do a settlement or reconciliation, that has to be truly and genuinely in the minds and hearts of our people, of our hapū, of our marae. We can easily breeze over that. In this day and age, we have to dive deeper and truly reconcile the grievance from 1840 to now, 1835 even.
So with your perspective as an insider, where is the process for a Ngāpuhi settlement at?
What I can see in my experience is that there is a shift in our people, partly the social stuff that we talk about, partly about since the last go we had it, it was coming on 10 years. A lot of water under the bridge has happened. I think in many ways we all want a settlement of some way, shape or form. And I think that we're starting to have those conversations. I see some really positive stuff happening on the ground now. This isn't what a government official will see, because literally they're not at the meetings I'm at. They wouldn't be able, if I was to look at some of the advice that perhaps ministers or government receive, it's not as accurate, I would say, as what I see. And what I see is our people are ready to be who they are, to finally live how they want. We're not going anywhere as Ngāpuhi. We haven't had a good time living under this system and regime. So there's some deep kōrero happening within marae and hapū around constitution, around a settlement, around reparation, the language being used. I think that's exciting, and I think that's really, really positive. What we do have to be sure of is protection of our hapū and of our people. You know, part of it is that balance that I would say is around having our people ready in a state, not worrying about what to put, kai to put on the table in the first instance, or paying their bills, so that they're in a state they can go to their marae, they can have a hapū hui, they can genuinely engage in what the settlement and build from there might look like. So this movement, this shift, I can say definitely for Te Runanga, A Iwo, Ngāpuhi, we have totally flipped our script in preparation for supporting our whānau and our hapū.
How have you flipped the script?
You've got to look at Te Runanga, A Iwo, Ngāpuhi in its entirety. This is an institution that was set up not by me, but by our tūpuna, some real stalwarts of Ngāpuhi Nui Tōne, the likes of Tahimi Henare being a chair, Patu Hōhepa, and also Rudy Taylor, for example. So there has always been a genuine drive to support our hapū. And like every organisation, there's been challenges along the way. So what we've done in my leadership in taking up the role of chairmanship is looked and sat, strategised around how do we totally flip the script to support hapū rangatiratanga, to support marae and whānau. We have a system where every month we meet with our marais. I, for one, meet with my local marais up to 24 at times, regularly, and look at the challenges. We also have two takiwā or system to cover Auckland, which we're really engaging to strengthen that. So the nuts and bolts are there, and we're saying we are going to do this for our hapū and for our whānau.
In the past, one of the most significant sticking points when it came to the settlement process from a Ngāpuhi perspective was the debate over the role of Ngāti Hine. And many within Ngāti Hine wanting to pursue a separate settlement from Ngāpuhi. Where do you stand on that?
I shall be very diplomatic in answering, not for any political reason or anything, because I share dual whakapapa. My whakapapa is te whānau prima ke roto o Ngāti Hine and within Ngāti Hine, and then my tahere side in Ngāpuhi. So I've always thought that through our histories, I've always been told and learned that Ngāti Hine is a hapū o Ngāpuhi tūturu, and all that richness of kawiti and honeheke over time and battle. And so I firmly believe we are, and many, many of us have that dual whakapapa, that Ngāti Hine has mana, Ngāti Hine is a hapū o Ngāpuhi. I have indicated, if I can say, currently working with Ngāti Hine and expressed to the Ngāti Hine leadership that I want this take, this wedge, as a person with dual whakapapa, or to be over in my reign or my chairmanship. So I've declared that. Whatever way and shape and form that takes, we will work through that, and we will have further hui on that. And part of our change in flipping our structure upside down is we have to listen to all hapū. For the sake of my generation and our both of our futures, we will see it through. I'm committed to seeing that through, whatever that looks like.
Coming up on Q&A, a top US official now warns a famine is underway in Gaza. We'll ask what it'll take to get more aid in. In the the last few months, the new government has reversed changes to smoking laws, although tobacco harm disproportionately affects Māori. They've forced ministries to change from having Māori first names. They've scrapped Te Aka Whai Order, the Māori Health Authority. And they've begun work on a controversial bill to define the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. But earlier this week, Mane Tahiri travelled to Wellington for his first formal meeting with the Treaty Negotiations Minister.
Isn't now a good time to reach a settlement? Don't you have leverage?
When we come and talk about leverage, sure, the new government could be seizing an opportunity to... That's definitely the sense I get from talking to ministers, the Prime Minister, that there is a real drive to settle Ngāpui. My number one question, though, and I have to come back to, is what is settlement? We as Ngāpui have to take the time to have a conversation. Is it settlement in the terms of language? Is it reparation? Am I reconciled as an individual, as a whānau, as a hapū, truly? And some of those conversations will take time. But we won't be, and we shall not be, rushed into pushing our whānau through to get there faster. You know, that's a billions and billion dollar question. Some will say the government's sent pot shots or taken pot shots. I don't think it's a pot shot, it's a bazooka. There's things they're actually doing that are an assault on Ngāpuhi. Because we are the kaitiaki of Te Tiriti, or Waitangi. Waitangi is within our rohe. Our chiefs took the initiative as well, as well as many other chiefs. We are the kaitiaki of Te Whakaputanga. It's a part of our ethos of being Ngāpui. So when those things are being shot at us, or we're being thing, I don't think they've felt the full wrath of Ngāpui in response.
You talked about the bazooka. There was one thing that really stuck out to me. I noted at the Hui Amotu at Tūranga Waiwai earlier this year, you showed up. And in the past, perhaps someone in your position might have made a deliberate decision not to attend a hui like that. Why did you attend?
There were many facets to that discussion. Initially, as the chair and of Te Runanga Aiwo Ngāpui, I pondered it. And I thought, if we were to make a move, let's make a move now. You know, that old, good old saying, never let a good crisis go to waste. And so it was seizing the opportunity around the galvanisation of Māori and the national issues. And I decided to call a number of huis and really was taken back by the attendance of our pre-hui before we went down, and it accumulated in Waitangi where we had hundreds and hundreds turn up. We also had a crew create a wire to go and have an account of this event. So a culminating number of things led to us to support this financially. You know, taking buses and all of these things, it was really important. Critically to the heart of all of that was... it was a show of force by Ngāpuhi that we may not have settlement or millions and billions of dollars, but we have numbers, the biggest iwi in Aotearoa, frankly, the world, and that we can and will flex, as we did many times in our history, around showing up united and in the context of today having a pakanga. So it was a huge show of force. By the time we had got to Tamaki, our contingent had grown in the hundreds. We met up with our whānau in Auckland and arrived at Tūranga Waiwai. And so that was a triggering point. For this organisation, we were on the right track.
Could you, as chair, support a settlement that was hugely beneficial for Ngāpuhi in terms of finances, whenua, if you feel at the same time the settlement is being reached with a government that does not support you in some of those other key areas?
I will say, I will be led by my hapū and by my whānau to give us direction as their ringa whakaruru towards do we settle or do we not. We are three times more likely to have our ngāpui tamariki under the system of oranga tamariki. Right this moment, there's 12,000 of our tamariki acceptable to that system. 5,000 actually in there. And you know, not everyone has that awareness. And so it definitely does weigh on those who can see both sides and what a settlement might do. But I do think we won't settle if we don't do it together as ngāpuhi. We won't settle if it's done to us. You know, the wealth of New Zealand, of Aotearoa, New Zealand probably back then, was built on the shoulders of ngāpuhi. Our land was stripped. We are literally a landless iwi, and the biggest iwi of Aotearoa, 165,000. And so when you're looking at that kind of deficit, it's pretty staggering. And then the wealth that on the opposite. So we have to really dive deep into educating our people to find the balance, whether we settle or not, and we go for that scenario. Because, as I said, there's some hardline benefit to receiving a financial package. The models and everything will have to be arranged and discussed.
You said that there is some momentum in this space at the moment. So on the balance of probabilities, if we are to pick an arbitrary time frame, 5 years, say, do you think it's more likely or not that Ngāpuhi can reach a settlement with the Crown within 5 years?
I think it's likely. I think it's likely. But you know what? The Crown can switch Ngāpuhi off just like that, and we'll go back and wait another 5 years.
What about within 3 years? What about within this parliamentary term? More likely than not?
Well, the jury's out again. I say the bazooka's been fired, and that doesn't bid well. Also, I think the Crown and its many ministries have to show up. They have to show up here in Kaikui. They have to show up in Hokianga on the east coast around bringing our well-being up. Now, that's outside of a settlement. You have a normal responsibility to do that. And we can time and time say the healthy living and the access to affordable, the living cost and affordable housing, those are still issues outside of settlement that are failing this government. Previous governments have failed for many years, decades. So.
It's Mane Tahiri. We spoke in Kaikohe earlier this week. Hey, so you know, as well as watching our show on TVNZ Plus, you can also find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZQ&A and we will pop right up. Stay with us, Q&A is back after the break. Hoki mai, welcome back. At the UN this week, Foreign Minister Winston Peters renewed his call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, in particular to allow aid organisations to work unhindered. It comes as the head of USAID warns a famine is already underway for some Palestinians in Gaza. Dr. Ritesh Shah is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Education and Social Work. He led research projects in Gaza and is an expert in the politics of aid.
Look, it's an absolute tragedy on so many levels. But the thing that I am most worried about is the young people, the children, the future generations of Palestinian young people who I've seen time and time again have to weather conflict after conflict. You know, children who are 18 now have lived through six different conflicts. So this is just the latest in a long-standing set of tragedies there.
Samantha Power, who's the head of USAID, warns that a famine may have already begun in Gaza. Just give us a sense of how grave that really is.
Look, I spoke to colleagues who are in Gaza right now, and what I've heard that is in fact already the case. That's especially the case in the north, where there's very little aid making it in, but also in other parts of Gaza where there is incredible competition for the scarce amount of food that's available, and that's actually leading to a lot of internal conflict and violence, and that's not being reported. So there's a grave sense of insecurity, and again, the people who are most affected are the young people.
There are multiple agencies that are trying to get aid into Gaza and distribute aid throughout Gaza. But I want to focus on UNRWA, which is the agency which for some time now has been providing aid to Palestinians. The New Zealand government is still considering whether or not it will continue to fund UNRWA after allegations suggested several workers from that agency perpetrated the October 7th attacks. Several other countries temporarily paused and then restarted their payments to UNRWA. But what do you make of the way that situation has played out?
I think there's a bigger story here. And I think we need to look back to 1949, which is when UNRWA was established. And it was established to be there as a temporary solution to the issue of Palestinian displacement after 1948. They were never meant to be a long-term agency there to support Palestinians indefinitely. They have always supported and advocated for the right of return to people's lands that were taken. But that has also become incredibly political. In terms of the current day, then, I think that we will probably eventually restart our aid, as most other countries have. But I think there's a bigger question at play, which is what's the long-term durable solution? And there are those who argue that UNRWA actually helps to sustain the occupation, that it enables Israel to maintain the status quo because it basically provides all manner of services to Palestinians who have been displaced since 1948, not just in West Bank and Gaza, but also in Lebanon and Syria, where, for example, the Palestinians have no rights to work or education if they are not citizens there.
Those are incredibly serious allegations, though, that people from UNRWA were responsible for the October 7th attacks. To be clear, New Zealand has continued to fund aid to Gaza through other NGOs in the meantime. But is it not a reasonable response for a country like New Zealand to pause payments to UNRWA or to, at the very least, investigate whether or not these allegations actually are true?
We're talking about 11 people that were under serious investigation out of a staff that they have of 30,000. Mm. So that's a very, very small percentage.
Nonetheless, the impact of those attacks is enormous.
Yes. And I think we need to understand that, you know, the employees of UNRWA, they are also people who live in Gaza and West Bank. They are Palestinians themselves, and they have lived through decades of the same conditions that they are also trying to mitigate and ameliorate. And so I think it raises a bigger question then of, can you expect humanitarian workers in any context to truly be impartial in a situation where you yourself are impacted by those conditions?
Are you saying that aid is inherently political, every dimension that goes into aid in these kind of circumstances?
Absolutely. And if we were to kid ourselves and think that humanitarianism is any different to other forms of aid is, I think, beguiling the true reality of the situation. If we look, for example, at where humanitarian monies goes, it shifts based on the wind and where geopolitical interests are at play. One year it might be Ukraine, the next year it will be Gaza, the next year it might be Yemen. It has nothing to do with actual need. It has to do with the interest of the donors who are supporting those responses.
I just know that there will be some people watching this interview who feel that potentially you are justifying any alleged involvement of an UNRWA worker in those attacks. And those attacks were barbaric. So just to be 100% clear, what is your position there? Were those attacks in any way justified?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And the employees, if they were found to be involved, they will be sacked. And I understand that that is the position of the UN and UNRWA. And in fact, there is an agreement that the United States had as part of resuming funding to UNRWA in 2018, when it withdrew funding, that said that from this point forward, UNRWA had to show that its staff were impartial. They had to provide a list of all their employees to the donors, and they needed to all be vetted. So I think UNRWA has an incredibly big responsibility to try to show transparency of its staff and their allegiances.
Back to the politicization of aid.
Yeah.
In recent weeks, the US has done a couple of extraordinary things when it comes to aid in Gaza. They have parachuted in aid. They have endeavoured to establish a temporary port through which to provide supplies. But at the same time, of course, the US supplies billions of dollars in weapons to Israel. What do you make of a country holding both of those positions at the same time?
I don't think it's anything new. We need to look back at what happened with the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. So we had the United States and New Zealand and other countries coming into Afghanistan to liberate the Afghani people, supposedly, and through military operations. And then on the other hand, providing education. Mm. And providing humanitarian relief. And that has become an increasingly common practice of the melding of kind of development, diplomacy, and defense efforts together. I think the contradiction in the case of the U.S. is quite stark, right? Because you have Samantha Power, as you mentioned, who's there as the lead of the aid agency, saying, you know, this is a horrific situation, it's a catastrophe. And then on the other, you have Congress currently debating, you know, allocating $16 billion of aid. So $16 billion of military aid versus $150 million of humanitarian assistance. It doesn't even compare.
For 4 years before the war, you led a study into children's well-being in Gaza. So if you can go back in time to a time before October 7th, what was your impression of life and of the outlooks and prospects for young people in Gaza?
So the study looked at children's well-being over 4 years, and we were tracking things like their sense of hope for the future, their ability to regulate their emotions, their ability to concentrate on their schoolwork, so on and so forth. And this was in a period marked by the pandemic. It was a period that was marked by another escalation in 2021, but also just a worsening situation due to the occupation. What we saw were significant declines in all aspects of children's well-being. So, for example, in 2019, 3 in 4 children felt hopeful about the future. By the time we ended the study in 2022, this had fallen to 1 in 5. So a huge drop in children's sense of hope for the future. Mm. In another aspect, we asked children if they felt safe at home. 9 out of 10 felt safe at home in 2019. Less than 1 in 10 felt safe at home in 2022. So it just goes to show you the marked declines in children's well-being that was occurring even before the current conflict.
I mean, I was going to say, you'd hate to think what those numbers would be today, right?
Absolutely.
It would just be zero and zero and zero on every front. So how will the last 6 months then fuel radicalization in that generation, the generation that you studied in Gaza?
You know, it's an interesting question, because I think you can say, well, it's going to create a lot more grievances against the occupier. But I would say that there's also a sense that this is the status quo. And when you speak to Palestinians, both in West Bank and Gaza, I think in some ways what they feel is that this current moment actually makes things much more transparent. So it's as crazy as it seems to say at the current moment, there is a sense of not going back. And I think in a way that might actually offer some possibilities for hope, for thinking about things differently. And I wouldn't poise it as this is just going to create grievances and new forms of radicalization. I would say that people are seeing possibility. They're seeing the idea that we can stop talking about the two-state solution. We can stop putting an idea that's no longer possible and viable off the table and actually call the situation for what it is. And I think for me, I have hope that whatever comes after this won't be a return to the status quo. That's why I don't think a ceasefire is enough now. I think what's going to have to happen is more than a ceasefire.
And what is more than a ceasefire?
I think thinking about coexistence. I think the idea of a two-state solution is dead. It's been dead actually since Oslo, because what happened was that the Palestinians had very little control over most aspects of the territory they had, and that's been shrinking and shrinking since. They don't have control over their education. They don't have control over their tax revenues. They don't even have control over their water. So in a sense, it's a de facto occupation. It's not independence. And now this is making it clear what it really is. And Israel has said as much. Israel has said, we're not going to go back to the status quo. So the question is, what is the alternative? You've got to have people from both sides being able to live together somehow.
That is Dr. Ritesh Shah. And that is Q&A for this week. From the Q&A team, thank you for watching. Nā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Thanks for your feedback. Hei, tērā wiki. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 a.m.
Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.